Welcome to Two Bards, One Mic. Insert interesting music here.
I swear we're actually going to get music one of these days.
Nah.
135.
135.
And this is the voice you get for this podcast because that's all I have.
We're coming to you with the sweet low sounds of Two Bards Jazz.
Yeah, I'm coming to you with the sweet low sound of coming off of influenza A.
Not B, not ladies B, and gentlemen.
Not C.
A.
So
this will be a sultry podcast.
Yeah,
with the Two Bards.
I don't know how sultry it is, but it definitely this is as loud as I can get.
This is going to be a fun one. I'm kind of excited.
Yeah, should be.
We
cool.
We should have a really heated debate like this. No, Andy.
Yeah.
I feel very vehemently, very passionately about this, and this is about as passionate as I get.
Well, get me going on superdelegates, and we'll have some fun there. No,
okay.
Don't actually do that.
No, we'll have to pot that down.
I caucused already. My caucus is out.
I don't want to hear about your caucus.
Okay. Well, caucus.
Was
that Tenacious? Is that Tenacious
Sorry.
D?
Sorry, I spiked there.
Oh, no, you didn't. Look, you're not red. Oh, man.
No, I'm a blue state.
So, my week is going to be really easy.
Okay.
I was sick.
You were sick. What about the week before you were sick?
The week before I was sick, I filmed a few shorts with Brian Lewis and Tom Brophy.
Nice.
At Big Fish Games. My job at work got actually reinstated.
Sweet. So, congratulations.
Here's a little background on that. QA was essentially eliminated.
Mm.
So the quality
Question
assurance
and answers. Oh.
No, the quality assurance engineering group was, and this happens.
Are those the testers?
Yes. This happens
great.
Frequently where someone will decide that you don't need dedicated testers. The developers can do it all. They can test and develop and everything.
We have phones that spies.
Yes.
That,
very, very much
that.
So.
Yes.
It's agile. It's one of the things that it's a cost cutting measure that agile methodology brings in that is great if you're making if you're making a phone app, but is absolutely stupid if you're making a major waterfall style
piece
application.
Of equipment, yeah.
So it was an idiotic move. They have since realized this, and it's easy to realize because your customers hate you. And as such, have reinstated sort of the QAE role to its original actual quality assurance focus instead of automation. it's like an automation and metrics reporting team is kind of what we turned into. So more like TPMs, technical program managers. So now that's happened, I'm much busier at work because I have work that matters again.
Yay.
And I can actually maybe succeed now, whereas I was in a position to fail, specifically because they said, hey, you're still a QAE, but that position doesn't exist. Good luck. So now I actually have a chance.
Well, I hope things get better.
I certainly hope so. And we'll find out over the next couple of months. So there's that.
Yay.
Yep, and then no idea where I picked this cold up or this influenza. I mean, it's straight up, it's legit flu, influenza. And I have no idea where I picked it up. I'm like the only person that's been hit by it, that I know directly.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess everyone else caught it back when it was popular and I waited to get it on DVD.
Well, sure. You never do anything because it's popular.
No, no.
Popular.
Really? You're gonna,
yeah.
Gonna wick it at me.
Gonna throw out a little Chenoweth.
Bueller. Funny story about that specific, not that song specifically, but I tweeted this a while ago, and if you hadn't read it, I highly recommend you jump on Netflix and watch Shrek the Musical. immediately. Because you know how Shrek was, it had a bunch of jokes about other animations and other movies in it?
Yes.
The theater, the musical, basically took that but applied it to stage. So all of its references were stage plays and other musicals.
It's on Netflix?
It's on Netflix, and it's fabulous. The production design on that movie, on that play.
It's a live action.
Yes.
On Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I'm doing tonight.
It'll take you a little bit of time to get over Shrek's voice, because it's not Mike Myers.
Right.
Donkey's easy, because it's obviously not Eddie Murphy. So the guy just comes out and owns it his own way. So Donkey's easier, but Shrek takes a little bit more time. What will blow your mind is Fiona. She only has a double once. Now, if you could think about the character of Fiona from Shrek, that's impressive, because something major has to happen to her
right.
a number of times throughout the story.
Right.
And she only has a double once. And it's wow. not even when you think it would be.
Yeah.
Technically it is probably the most impressive stage play I've ever seen.
Well,
ever
done.
The technical execution is magnificent.
Cool. I'm excited.
Yep. So that's my week. How are your weeks?
My weeks. I can't remember 2 weeks ago very well. What was I doing? Head class. I helped Brophy prepare for one of the days of the glitch shoot, and we had a blast working on that stuff in class. It was great, just cutting up, and I think that made him feel pretty confident going in that day. I know that the second day, he didn't have the prep, and he's been working a lot. And so that was what it was.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was, but it was what it was.
It wasn't so bad. There was just one. I think we actually had to abandon it, and it wasn't necessarily related to that. It was more just tone didn't fit.
Right.
But there was one where you had a block of dialogue on the second day, and I mean a block. About Pokemon.
Yeah.
And
I was reading it, and I'm like, I'm kind of up on this stuff, and I don't. That's a lot.
Yeah, but, so...
Tyler, in Tom's defense on the whole thing, four, quote, sections with about 10 sections each, while you got a 50-hour-a-week job...
Right.
...is an awful lot to cram into one day.
Right. Most of them, though, we were able to either... we weren't able to do cue cards, and that's what killed us on that last one. They were, it sucked. They were flaring light everywhere. They were making noise. You could see them in the cameras. You could see them in Brophy's glasses. So we couldn't do cue cards. But for the rest of the stuff, they were able to tape their lines to their screens, and they were supposed to be working anyway.
Right.
So it made it much easier and much nicer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So still great performances. They're hilarious. I've seen a few of them.
And then this week, I was at Amazon twice.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
The Elliott office, where the Amazon studios are.
Right, right.
And I had an audition and then a callback.
Ooh, cool.
To play a wizard. And I'm really kind of hoping it happens.
Well, you have... You have a little bit of know-how in that arena.
I do. And remember back in the day, there was, I think it was right when we started this podcast, SIF and the city were putting together a little five-part little actor going around how to Seattle.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that, yeah.
It was that same director, and he remembered me when I walked in.
Very cool.
And so we had a lot of fun doing the setups. Now, I'm up against the top talent in Seattle.
The top wizards.
Lowell Dio.
Okay.
Beautiful African-American gentleman. my age-ish, maybe a little older. Andrew Tribolini.
I know Andrew Tribolini.
Very unique look, older gentleman.
Yep.
Me, big beardy guy.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think I beat out all the other beardy guys.
Yeah.
But I'm the middle-aged beardy Caucasian guy. Then yeah, versus Lowell is the middle-aged African-American, right. And Andy is the older, gaunt, you know. So it's going to be, it's now no longer down to talent. Did I do good enough? I already did that part. Now it's, how does it stack up with everybody else? Right. Who are we going to put as a warrior? Who are we going to put as a queen?
Right. Is Andy Tribolini the guy who was in that spoon, Heaven or Spoon bit with Keeter at the desk?
I'm not sure.
He's like all teeth and skin.
Bald.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He lives in West Seattle.
No.
No?
No.
Okay, then I'm thinking of someone else.
Yeah.
Because he was at my caucus on Saturday. Oh,
okay. No, so he was lives Curtis. Under the Battery Street Bridge off of where you take Elliot.
Yeah.
Sorry, Western Avenue.
Right.
And then go up. He's right there.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Still might be in the same caucus. I don't know how the caucus lines are drawn.
It's really weird, but I don't think he would have been.
Okay.
He might have just been there to, like, visiting someone. I don't know.
Sure.
Curtis Eastwood was there, though. That was really cool. Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, I did that for a couple days. I shot on a student film for Cornish.
Oh, yeah?
Got to play a boxing coach manager. And that was very fun. That was fun to give back. And met a friend of mine that had taken the Nikkei class that I took.
Right.
And I did not remember him. And he was like, you don't remember me, do you? Huh. And it's Duran. And he was great as the boxer. We were down at Evolve Evolution Gym.
Isn't that the Stinky Fruit? Well, that's Evolve. Durian. That's Durian.
Yeah. No. Duran is not Stinky Fruit.
Okay. Evolve.
But we were at an actual boxing gym.
Right.
So we were in the ring. And it was a whole lot of fun. Did some pickups on Saturday.
Nice.
And then last night I went and saw Hedda Gabler at Harlequin Productions. My friend Aaron Lamb did a completely new translation of it. So he took the original work, the French translation, the English translation, and then he ran it through two other, he translated the French, he translated the Norwegian, I think, and then modernized the whole thing. The set was amazing.
Very cool.
And the costumes were phenomenal, lighting, everything, and my contribution to the whole thing, other than a hopeful candidate for BRAC, was I supplied all the laptops for them.
Oh, cool.
And instead of it being a manuscript that's being written, it is a laptop that carries all of the work.
Got it.
And
that's really cool.
They helped to move that along because they had pictures from the honeymoon that they had on a tablet.
Okay, gotcha.
So, hey, look at this. And Jorgen has his own laptop that he comes in and holds out a USB drive and puts it in. Can you imagine all the works of blah, blah, blah that I've ever done are on this? And when Eilert Loveborg comes in, he says, this is the only copy. It never leaves my side.
Wow.
And during the course of the evening, it leaves his side. He has it, and Hedda destroys it. The set was on a revolve.
Right.
And they had some really cool, I don't know what you'd call it, Bjork-ish music. I don't even know what kind of style that is.
But Icelandic rock?
Ish, yeah. And
screaming and
she
dragons?
Starts looking at it. She puts it down. She goes back. She grabs a glass of champagne. And she's fuming, and all of a sudden the revolve starts to turn. And it is at a pretty good pace.
Right.
It's like a 33 RPM record.
Wow.
And she all the time she is walking on this thing, she walks, And the back end is probably not quite a half. So maybe a third is the back walls and sliding doors. Mm-hmm. And the front two-thirds is open. So this thing starts spinning around. She walks back, grabs the laptop, puts it down as the stage revolves out to center, and you have a clear sight line of what she's doing. Mm-hmm. And it's revolving around, and she walks around, and then at the opposite end, she comes around and grabs the hatchet.
Wow.
And it's still revolving, and she's walking back to where the computer is.
Right.
And just starts, crack spider web on the screen, keys nice. Flying up off the keyboard, and the revolver. So all of this kinetic energy is all mm-hmm. happening, and it was such a beautiful moment.
That's really
cool. So well choreographed. And it was a really great adaptation, mm-hmm. wonderfully done by people. So
very cool.
That was a lot of fun. And then I'm here.
Nice, nice.
So that pretty much
very cool.
That brings us to now, 15 yeah. minutes into the podcast.
This is gonna be a short.
It's got to be short. This is really.
I'm sorry, guys.
We promise this is going to be a short podcast
because I just don't have it in me. The fact that I was able to get here today is pretty.
I'm thankful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because so. I've missed you, my friend.
I've missed you as well.
If nothing else, these yep. little. Times we get to hang out, and I like it.
Right. So should we get to questions then?
We should get to questions now that we've,
talked about.
We're done touching ourselves. We're not going to go to questions.
Well, I'm not done. I'll keep going for a while, but.
True.
You know
speaking
me.
Of.
Yes, speaking of.
Being at a caucus earlier, mm-hmm. Thomas Brophy at the Thomas Brophy writes, with Washington State Democratic caucus going on, if Bernie and Hillary were superheroes, who would they be and why?
Well, Bernie would be the hero that America needs, not necessarily the hero America wants.
Which of the superheroes would that be?
Isn't that Batman? Or is that Harvey Dent before he's Two-Face? I don't know. Hillary would be status quo. I respect Hillary Clinton. I do, but I'm a lifelong liberal. I've mm-hmm. been liberal since back when liberalism was liberal.
Right.
There's been a slight, it's funny because in the rest of the world, there's been a march very slowly to the left, mm-hmm. As people realize that their personal worlds can't dictate everything in the outer world. You make the compromises and you try to make 80% of the people happy 80% of the time.
Right.
So, and you'll get your turn being happy in that world. But back when Reagan was the most right-wing person we'd ever seen, mm-hmm. And we'd just come off of Jimmy Carter, who wasn't really as bad as everyone thinks he was,
no.
and as an ex-president has been just amazing.
Yes.
And that's not even
presidents are.
That's not even a political thing.
No.
Like because what he's done has had no real political leanings. He's mm-hmm. just been going out being a decent human being, building
human.
Houses with cancer and stuff. I mean, the houses aren't built with cancer. He had cancer while he was building houses. Yeah. So I mean, I guess you could build a house with cancer, but I don't know how you get the tumors to hammer the nails in. You need one of those ones with teeth in it.
Yeah.
I can do that. That doesn't hurt my throat. So
Andy will now do the rest of the podcast as a series of ticks and talks.
Yeah. But to me, Hillary Clinton, and even Barack Obama in a lot of ways, is more like what a moderate Republican would have been back in that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like the kind of moderate Republican that wouldn't have ever won back in that time because, the 80s was all about me, 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 me.
Right.
So, but that sort of moderate Republican is what these moderate liberals have kind of turned into because the line, it's not their fault, it's the line that's pushed.
Right.
Minus, of course, there is a second line that moves separately about sort of social issues and things like that. Not about government sponsored programs or education or anything like that, but about like, oh, you know, like you can't really call things like racial equality a partisan thing. They're not. They're a humanist thing that kind of all moved at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yes, you could easily argue that people on the right side of things put up more resistance to it just because classically they do, but everyone knew it was going to happen. Same thing's happening now. Like, you are getting some social progression. Gay rights is a really good example of even people on the right are like, you know, it needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still happening. So overall, a lot of social issues are moving forward. They're not moving to the right or the left. They're just moving forward. But the crux of progressivism and liberalism and whatnot, that centrist bar has moved to the right pretty consistently since the 80s. It did have a pretty good jump back in the mid 90s. But even then, Clinton was a very moderate liberal. Bill Clinton,
that right.
was a very moderate liberal. And as much as people are like up in arms with, oh, he did expand a number of defense spending plans and things like that. He was a moderate liberal, but mm-hmm. Hillary is even by that definition of liberal a moderate conservative. And she's become more liberal over the last, you know, 5 years or so, as culture has shifted around her and she's felt the need to do it. But I would also say that Barack Obama is more of a moderate conservative with a few liberal leanings,
mm-hmm.
Very moderate, very middle of the road, but primarily still, if you're measuring them against the grand scheme of things, definitely, you know, you're not, it's not an FDR situation.
Right.
All politicking aside though, what superheroes would they be? That's a really, really tough question. I don't think anyone is outstanding enough to be a superhero. Trump could be a supervillain. Guaranteed, Trump could be a supervillain because he is the Joker. I mean, that dude is chaos. Nobody knows if he's even serious. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know. You don't know if he gets the nod, he's going to, like, pull a 180. He's done it before. You know, he's voted Democrat before. He supported Democratic campaigns. He supported Hillary, you know? So in a way, I guess that makes Hillary Batman, doesn't it? If he's the Joker.
Well, she does have money.
They both have a lot of money.
Yes.
He has more, but that we know about. That's the other thing is, let's not forget that, and this is on Bill as well as Hillary, but they did use their political power to buy land cheaper than they should have. And there was a massive conflict of interest there.
Yep.
And that did happen, and it settled out of court. But the fact of the matter is, you have someone running for president who has abused political power, and it was proven in the past.
Yes.
But then again, like, that's most people, isn't it? Like, most people, most candidates are like that.
Oh, I think so. That's how they got to be where they are. They learned to use political power.
Right, right. So
I think Bernie's the superhero that people should pay attention to, but nobody does.
Right.
So I'm going to say he's Aquaman.
Oh, dude, that's a good point. He's the Invisible Man because he can't get a fucking camera point. Or he's Spider-Man, right? He can't get a camera pointed at him unless it's him doing it.
Yeah. And I think Hillary's just the superhero everybody sees, but doesn't... She's the comedian.
Oh, from Watchmen. That's actually really... That's pretty damn good, Scott. Damn. Thanks. That's really good. So, I will say straight up, and, you know, I know that we don't tend to get super political a lot of the time. We do get political occasionally, but we don't get super political a lot of the time. Yeah. I will say that this time around, I am absolutely, positively, 100% against everybody running on the right, period. Everybody on the right. Terrible. Just terrible. It's a situation where, like, I wish a comet would take out everybody except for, like, a Ron Paul. Because then at least you'd have, like, a person who wouldn't end our fucking planet the second they took office.
Right.
And then on the left, I'm not... I'm definitely more pro-Bernie, like, all down the board in terms of my own personal views.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to be, like... I'm not going to be one of those people who's like, I'm not voting for Hillary and not vote. It's too important, you know, but more importantly than all those guys, like these, we keep talking about these guys as superheroes. Screw all the presidential candidates because they're very limited superheroes.
Yes.
You need the supporting cast. Go vote in your local elections. Get the people with the actual power to change shit into office and vote out the people who've been in there for 800 years.
Yes. To wit, I am now enhancing my bid as the Des Moines mayor.
You're potted down really far, man.
I am. I was doing that to be...
I think you moved away a little bit is the problem.
Well, but I'm I can't even see straight with the pop filter, so I'll pot up a little bit.
Yeah,
no,
just do
no,
it.
Because then it'll even out. You
just even leave it out. We'll fix
I don't edit
post.
Anything, but we do normalize.
Yeah, we do.
So... I'm going to leave that there.
Yeah.
And because I want to still have listeners, I'm not going to talk about my political leanings this time. Rob McLennan writes, short.
Oh, we can all agree. We can all agree that Ted Cruz is the tick.
Yeah.
Just really stupid and righteous in his own head.
Yeah. So much the tick. Rob McLennan writes, story workshop time.
Okay.
So the apocalypse has struck. But the gods of comedy have started it. What is the nature of the impending doom, and who are the heroes fighting to save humanity?
The nature of the impending doom, of course, is giant syphilis. Not actually sexually transmitted, just it's grown and mutated into its own little animal, and it chases you around.
Giant syphili.
Giant syphilises.
Syphilises, okay. Yeah,
cephalopods.
Okay, I can see that. So then...
Who's fighting
so
it?
Then the heroes would... Well...
The ghost of Benjamin Franklin, duh, for one.
Yes, I would also say the religious right, unfortunately, in this case, would be the heroes.
But for the first 10 years, they wouldn't agree. They would think that it was no threat to them.
Right, and that's how it got a foothold to become the threat that it was.
Right, right.
But then they'd realize that, well, damn it, we just need to bury our crucifix and come together.
I guess Planned Parenthood Man would be a good one. But, no, I mean, that's the thing, though. It's like, at this point, they're not sexually transmitted anymore, right? So the right would be okay with...
Pee-pee Man.
Pee-pee Man, yeah. You just don't want to get it near the Washington Monument, or it'll constantly have something coming out of the tip, and it'll
I think
it'll
maybe that's how they actually defeat it.
Oh, right.
They herd them all, and they go, oh, look, there is our God. We should all... And then they just nuke Washington, D.C.
Oh, nice.
And that's how they defeat it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we should shoot that as a short.
Let's do
Maybe stop motion. We'll get Bo to build the Lego city, and then we'll just have, you know, like cotton candy syphilis.
Would it be called the syphiling?
It could be.
Syphilnado.
Rob has a second question that he would like to bring up.
Uh-huh.
If we were asked... Okay, I'm going to read it as he's written it. If you were asked to your one most impactful piece of advice... So I think it's supposed to be give. If you were asked to give... Your one most impactful piece of advice on the craft of acting rather than the business of acting, what would it be?
Well, that's a you question.
Oh, I have this.
Because my answer would
so
be...
So in spades.
Talk to real actors.
For me, it is two things. It is truth in everything. Not your truth.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of what is on the page and reacting. Because acting is listening and reacting. Memorization of a script. Anyone can recite Mary Had a Little Lamb. Boom. You've just memorized something. You get up in front of a group of people and recite that poem, you are now a performer. But you're not necessarily an actor. So someone in a give and take or banter, much like we do here on the podcast.
Mary, my God, I remember when she got her lamb. It was 1987, springtime. It was raining a lot that year. I remember that. I remember that really clearly. And she walks in with this lamb, so little, little lamb. Oh man, it's fleece. It was white. It was snow white. I'm not kidding, man. Snow white. Huh. And I'll tell you, man, literally everywhere she went, that lamb was with her. Everywhere. End scene.
That still wasn't acting. No, that was lovely.
That was storytelling.
I
can't really. It's radio.
Yes. Which is why voice acting to me is sometimes such a weird thing to call it. But right. I think it boils down to when we did Joe's Diner, one of the things that my character was, he was sort of a bargain basement Tony Robbins motivational speaker type guy.
Banana hands.
But it was, they coined the phrase, and I will gladly wear this as my moniker, that I believe in toes up acting. From the very tips of your toes to the top of your head, you have to be that thing. John Travolta says before he does anything with a character, he figures out how he walks.
Man, I wish I had my voice. This would be a good time for a John Travolta impression, but I don't have it in me. I just don't have it.
And please don't, because that'll set us back another 2 weeks.
I know.
But, you know, he figures that out. He figures out the most basic needs of that character. Now, that's, you know, that's getting way deep into acting and embodiment and all that. But what it basically comes down to is the truth. He is finding the truth of that character in the way he's doing it. Sopranos.
Tony Soprano, the guy?
Yeah. Why am I drawing a blank on
him? Oh, because he's dead?
Yeah. I keep wanting to say D'Onofrio. It's not
D'Onofrio. No, Gandolfini.
Gandolfini. James Gandolfini. So when he would be in Sopranos and have to be doing a scene where he's just mad all the time, he put a pebble in his shoe.
That'll do it.
And he didn't take it out. And he walked everywhere with that quote, method acting. Because I'm finding a way to put myself into a position of being angry so that when the cameras roll, I am angry. That's a school of acting. Tom Brophy comes from a lot of training in Meisner, which putting yourself in imaginary circumstances and these things. And I just think that everything you need is on the page. And if you are true to the character and you have empathy for the plight of what is going on, whether you are Bill Sykes, one of my favorite characters was Bill Sykes. I mean, I got to come on stage singing a song, beat five guys up in a bar, beat kids, beat my girlfriend, kidnap a kid, and get shot and die. I mean, how much more can you want in the span of a 2-hour show? I got to do everything that I never get to do as a human being.
Right.
Nor would I ever do as a human being. But we've all got the potential to be those things. You just have to let it out.
Right.
So, truth and reacting. Those are my most impactful piece of advice in the craft of acting.
What Scott said.
And last question of the cast goes to Paula Moran, who writes, any opinions on the popularity of the Cthulhu mythos in current gaming and fantasy? What is Cthulhu?
What is Cthulhu? Cthulhu
that,
is...
That shows the popularity.
Cthulhu is one of the pantheon of elder gods created by Howard Philip Lovecraft.
Ah.
To
better
sort of
known
populate,
as H.P. Lovecraft.
Correct. To sort of fill his fantasy works. So the concept that there are dimensions outside of our own and that we were fodder for multidimensional or extra-dimensional beings, sort of ancient beings that were there before the dimensions unfolded and things like that.
Is that the squid-like mind
Cthulhu's,
flayer thing?
Cthulhu's the squid-like mind flayer thing. Okay. And Cthulhu mythos is all of it, not just Cthulhu himself, but like, you know, Nyarlathotep, and all of those, Yogg-Sothoth, those crazy cats, Migos.
So the Cthulhu mythos being what, extra dimensional?
Basically, they're monsters. They're monsters of the id, more than anything.
Okay,
it's something that you can't see and to look or imagine, and to look upon it is to go mad. So, okay. So you have stories that basically it describes something terrifying, but leaves out. It gives you basic details, but everything else you have to make up on your own, so it makes it scarier because you're going to make up something scarier than you could read off of a page because
like,
of personal fear.
Reservoir Dogs.
Right.
Most violent film ever that has not one moment, one second, one millisecond of violence anywhere in the film. There is nothing captured on film that is violent or a violent act.
Just the aftermath.
Just the aftermath.
Lots of blood. But,
yes.
But
yes.
Lots of blood. No gore. Actual hits, no actual... You don't see the guy's ear get cut off. Or,
nope.
Yeah.
That's all left to your imagination to fill in the blanks.
So, that being said, my take on it is, it's fine. It happens all the time, right? You end up zombies. Were they, I at this point, I prefer Cthulhu to zombies just because we're at such peak zombie. I'm done with zombies. Mm-hmm. There are interesting ways to do zombies, but no one's doing them in interesting ways. They're literally just using them in their basest sense to get their stories moving.
Mm-hmm.
Cthulhu though is being utilized that way as well. So you don't have people telling new and interesting stories that introduce new anything. It's just the elder gods drive someone crazy and that person does, you know. So it has a very, very high potential to be sort of pumped dry very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the racist problem, which is just what it is. H.P. Lovecraft was a terrible, terrible racist. And you could say, well, he's a product of his time, but I disagree with that because you have people like Robert Ingersoll Green. These are well-known philosophers about race, about humanity. This wasn't, this wasn't the 1700s. He wasn't Dutch. You know, we knew at that time that black people didn't have, we being white Europeans, knew at that time that black people didn't have any problems with learning when compared to white people or anything like that. He just liked being racist.
Right, but is it in the Cthulhu, is it in his
yeah,
books?
There's a few of them. He has
a
few poems.
I mean, he, as an individual, was racist.
But it drips in a little bit.
Sure, it drips, just so, as C.S. Lewis has Christianity drip in just a little bit to Narnia, even though when I first read it, I had no idea it was an allegory.
The movie with the Jesus lion has a little bit of Christianity in it?
Right.
All right.
But when I read the book as a small child, I didn't read it as that.
Right.
I read it as three kids going
gotcha.
In. So there is some of, not so much a message or anything, but there's an influence of that goes in. But the stories of Cthulhu are not in and of themselves a racist message.
I don't think they are. They don't need to be. Like, I think that You have to be very understanding, though, if someone doesn't want to do it because of that.
Sure. 100%. I'm just curious because I don't know.
The only other thing that I have to say about this that makes it a little bit more difficult is when Cthulhu was on a page and couldn't be described, and you were left to be terrified of something you couldn't see or comprehend.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary.
Yeah.
When you have to render that thing on a game board, on a computer screen, on a film screen, it loses a lot.
It loses a lot.
Because Cthulhu's not really... Like, the most you get with Cthulhu... Even now, the scariest or most chilling pictures of Cthulhu-type monsters are ones where you don't see everything. The second it becomes, oh, look, it's a weird bat-winged, squid-faced thing. It's Davy Jones from...
Cloverfield.
It's Cloverfield, yeah. The second it becomes that, it just loses all of its ability to scare you.
Right.
The exact reason they cut that scene from Alien where you see the alien crab walking, because it was, you could see too much and it looked ridiculous, and having it moving in the dark and only seeing glimpses of it made it much more scary. That's what I think is the problem. It's zombies have always been, they're scary not because of what you see, they're scary because they mass up and they have, they can't be reasoned with.
Right.
Cthulhu is scary because Cthulhu mythos people are scary because of what you can't see and what you don't know. So it's really hard to make that super mainstream because it just loses something with every telling. So that's how I feel about that. I think it'll be pumped dry really quick. And most attempts to do anything with it that are that try to show anything have been terrible.
Yeah. Well, I think that its popularity arises from, I mean, obviously all of our horror stories, for the most part, are cyclical. So all of our initial fairy tales were really Brothers Grimm horror stories meant to keep kids in line. No one remembers the Disney Cinderella that the Wicked Stepsisters got blinded. They left that out of, you know, those things when I was growing up. But also when I was growing up, we had Creature from the Black Lagoon, which was awesome, or Frankenstein, or Werewolf, or the Mummy. So there were all these supernatural beings, and that's what scared people.
Right.
You know, when I went swimming in the pool and had to do the breaststroke after I just watched Creature from the Black Lagoon, I'm looking down and seeing the big drain grate at the bottom of the pool going, he can come up through there and I don't want to do the backstroke. Or literally, I switched what I wanted to do for a living, which was to be a marine biologist for the longest time until I was in a pool watching Jaws.
Nice.
And went, okay, fuck that. I can't.
Well, that's a really good point you bring up, too.
Because then zombies,
right,
with George Romero, really nobody had talked about that. And it was the most independent of independent films back in Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania or wherever the fuck they did that thing.
Pittsburgh is in Pennsylvania.
But... which was just... you know, hey, we're on a lark, we're going to do this thing, we've got some extra ends, we're going to make a movie, and it takes off. And even when it did, that was it. It was its own thing, and not till decades later...
Do you want to define what extra ends means for our people?
Oh, so when you're shooting on film, you use X amount, and then there's the tail end of 10 feet or whatever that's not exposed... they would cut those off and they'd just be in a pile. And so George Romero got a bunch of these and taped them all together to make full reels that you could use. And they were way cheaper than buying a regular reel, and he had to do a lot of work, but he had them. And so he had free media, kind of like today where we can just go shoot digitally. It doesn't really cost anything except buying the equipment. But then... There were no zombies for a while, and then all of our horror stuff was like, okay, that's all done. We've done the scary monsters, we've done the... And then it was all the hostile stuff, and Saw, and Centipede, and just weird, you know, Texas, basically Texas Chainsaw Massacre stuff. Let's right. cut on people.
Well,
what
hold on.
Can be horrific?
What became the bad guy? People.
Right.
Humans became the, in Human Centipede, the doctor's yep. a bad guy. Saw's the bad, people became the monsters.
Right.
And now we're going back to monsters being monsters.
Monsters being monsters. And if they do it right, mm-hmm. I think a great way for a Cthulhu movie to succeed mm-hmm. is in the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So that the viewer still has to conjure up what is driving this person insane. Right. We never see anything through the victim's eyes. We just see the result of what happens to the victim.
Right.
Then I think you have something that is within the pathos right. of what Cthulhu was in book form,
mm-hmm.
which was something indescribable that the participant reading mm-hmm. had to envision. Right. And therefore, in a movie setting, you have to make something so horrific that the viewer fills in those blanks.
Right.
But showing the big squid tentacly thing up in the air, it's like, oh, I'm what?
Yeah,
you look like a plushie.
Exactly. I mean, a few people have done it. Look at the 1983 John Carpenter's The Thing. That was essentially mm-hmm. a Cthulhu story. That was essentially in the Mountains of Madness. Mm-hmm. It wasn't entirely in the Mountains of Madness because that was a much different story, but same kind of thing, isolation, and then these creatures.
Really see the creatures, did we?
But we did. We saw them quite a bit. But what did they do? Instead of making unique monsters, they took the animals that these things were taking over and turned them into, so you took something familiar and made it grotesque.
Okay.
That's why it was okay to do it. Like when a dog's head rips open and has teeth inside, that's grotesque. And you can identify with that.
Right.
Because you look over at your dog and you're like, you just fucking stay there.
Right. Know? But we didn't see the thing.
We saw what the thing embodied
and correct. Did to.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
So, there's a great book by Stephen King. It's nonfiction. It's called Danse Macabre.
Hmm.
And D-A-N-S-E and then macabre, M-A-C-A-B-R-E that talks about horror, and he talks specifically about what you're talking about, where he went to, because he watches a lot of horror films,
mm-hmm.
Which is funny because he's actually terrified of them.
Yeah.
But he goes anyway, so it's like almost torture for him to do that. But in the 80s he went to this one called House. And it wasn't scary to him at all. And he didn't understand why people were finding House scary.
Mm-hmm.
And then this yuppie couple in front of him, the man turned to his date and he said, oh my God, can you imagine what that would do to the resale value? And he got it. He's like, oh, this isn't a horror movie for me. The thing about Lovecraft, about specifically Cthulhu, is because you never see it,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have that problem.
Right.
It's horror for everybody because mm-hmm. it's horror. It's the horror of what's outside the cave.
Yeah.
It's the horror of being so scared in your bed because something's scraping the window and then waking up the next morning and realizing it's a bush. You know, nobody's scared of a bush, but when the lights are out, you're scared as shit of whatever's scraping your window.
Because you don't want to look.
Right.
Because you've already imagined something far worse yeah. than it could ever be.
So the,
you hope.
Yeah. The monster was a bush, but what it really comes down to is it was you. And that's what I meant by monsters, the id. And so the whole Lovecraftian Cthulhu thing is about monsters from the id, which, by the way, is where Doom, the company that made Doom, got its name.
Id right.
Software. Yeah. So, but yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. The only way to make a lasting, impressionable piece of film, at least around it, would be to not show anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, show the aftermath, show what it can do, show how people react to it, but never show it.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I know you want to stop talking for a while.
I after this podcast ends, I'm going to just be hacking for like probably 5 minutes. So be prepared.
I will prepare myself, and we will save our listeners from that yeah. fate.
And for all of our supporters, I don't know how far I've been so out of it. I don't know how far behind we are on our supporter rewards.
We are two behind on deliverables.
Cool.
For supporter rewards.
So I apologize, but being sick, I don't have a really solid. It'll come at this point, but we're gonna try and get those to you guys. Just it won't be for a couple of weeks, probably at the earliest.
But they are in the works. We have some wonderful things planned.
Yep.
It's just between my sick, Andy's sick. We want to give you the right thing. So bear with us and you will be amply rewarded. But on that note, Neil deGrasse Tyson, if you would like to come on and explain why influenza A happens.
Actually, why don't you come on and explain how a being that exists in five dimensions could impact us in the third, in three dimensions. That would be more fun.
That would be okay. I defer my question and give the floor to Andy on the questions. But to all those, as we mentioned, our
how
Patreon
to train your day
gone.
How to train your day gone.
We would like to give extra special thanks to everyone this week. Hawk Robinson.
Leslie Sedlak.
Todd McKimmy.
Donald Evans.
Zombie Orpheus Entertainment.
Bradley Swan.
Gordon D. Duke.
Digby Davis, LLC.
Paula Moran.
Amanda Cook.
Mark Bevier.
Mike Ott.
James Herbert.
Adam Morey.
Matthew Hunt.
Mike Thompson.
Tim Martin.
Rob McLennan.
Lotta Jerf.
Laura Adams.
Tom Brophy.
I can't see anymore because now the thing's in the way. Donald Evans.
Dougie Sharp.
Justin Everett.
Brittany Bentley.
Brad Roberts.
Jennifer Reifenberry.
Rival Guy.
And Chad Jones.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you so very much, and we will see you all in your ear holes next week.
Watch out for the syphiloids.